open portion of our January 22nd, 2024 work session. We have talk about the future of recycling for Columbia. Dave Sorrell, I'm assuming I'm kicking over to you.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to thank everybody on the council for letting us come talk to you this evening. As you're aware, we hired RRT Engineering to do an evaluation of our recycling program and our material recovery facility and make recommendations. They got a rather lengthy report that we provided to you in December, and we have some thoughts on some of the recommendations, but we want to get some guidance, and so that's what we hope to accomplish this evening. With me tonight is Steve Hunt. He was formerly the acting or assistant director for solid waste. He's now with water, but he's not abandoned us. And then I got Nick Paul, the recovery superintendent, and Damon Crum, the collection superintendent, here to help assist with questions as needed. So RRT provided their final report in November of last year. We forwarded it to council in December. And like I said, they provide a lot of recommendation, but we need direction from council on what we do with our material recovery facility, our recycling drop-off centers, our method of curbside collection, and just overall program modifications. So in RRT's report, one of their options, their option one, was just basically decommission the MRF and transport all our materials to other facilities for processing. Well, there's not much capital cost there, but we'd have to have a long-term contract with some other material recovery facility. We have not yet been able to identify one that was willing to take the material. And their fees are typically $80 to $100 per ton. And then transportation costs would be expensive. We think that would add about $1.67 million to our annual operating cost. We're not recommending that we go with that route. The other drawback on this is other facilities may severely limit the materials that we were able to collect and recycle. The second option they provided was to retrofit or upgrade the existing MRF. And it's basically constructing a new system inside the existing building. The capital costs that RRT identified was about $9 million. It wouldn't allow for any future growth. All the material would have to be transported to a different facility during construction, so it would still come with that $1.6 million annual cost while it's being constructed. The third option was to construct a new MRF on the current site. They identified a capital cost of about $17 million. There again, we'd have to transfer material to another facility during the construction at that $1.67 million a year.
I do have one question on your brief sheet here, which says capacity. What is TPH?
Tons per hour.
Thank you.
And then, yeah, we get 2 to 3 tons per hour now for containers, 4 to 5 for fiber. We'd get a little bit of increase if we did a new equipment in the existing or constructing a new MRF on that existing site. Their fourth option was to construct a new MRF at a different location on the landfill. They identified a capital cost of approximately $28 million, which I personally wonder if that extremely larger amount is truly valid. I think some of that would have to do with how much automated equipment you put in it, because I don't know that the existing building is worth the value of the difference. We wouldn't have to transport material to another facility while we were building this one. And we'd get a capacity of 3 tons per hour for containers and 8 tons per hour of fiber. So we're recommending that we don't consider options one or two. I think closing down the MRF in its entirety is not going to be a long-term solution for us. And then we have the high transportation and processing costs to do that. And we would recommend that we proceed with a hybrid between options 3 and 4. We have funding available for the phase 2 of the MRF now, and we could use that funding to issue an RFP for engineering services to do a preliminary design. We could then have a public hearing, come back with final design if we were directed to move forward. And then if we move forward with it, I would recommend we use bond funds to pay for construction costs. I calculated the financing based on the range of capital costs that they provided. It would be about 1.2 to 2.2 million annually for principal and interest. That'd be a 4.5 to 8.4% rate increase if we spread that cost over all rates in the utility for landfill tip fees, commercial, residential, everything. It'd equal about a 78 cent to $1.46 monthly increase for residential customers. One of the reasons we believe that this would be a better option is it would allow us to basically utilize a portion of the existing building while expanding and then retrofit the existing facility for like household hazardous waste, community drop-offs where they could bring mattresses or styrofoam or other types of materials to one centralized location at the landfill.
And do you want to stop on your first section? You kind of have three different, okay, questions. Yeah, Betsy.
This is the MRF Phase 2 project for design. Do we already have something scheduled?
Yes, that's money basically for the design, to begin the design of this, but it was pending the results of what our recommendations were here, and that's the money I would propose to use if you want us to go ahead and prepare an RFP.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Rachel.
I have two questions. One, in option, I think it's 4, what would be some options for repurposing the facility, because that's the one where you build it on a new site?
Yes, what we're thinking is expand the existing building at its current location and utilize a portion of that, and then repurpose the part that we leave in operations while we're building the addition, and then use it for household hazardous waste collection or to expand, like maybe collect mattresses if somebody wants to bring them in, or electronics, styrofoam, some things that we currently don't process.
And then, I don't know if I missed this, my second question is, how much currently sits in the capital improvement, the solid waste CIP?
Total, I don't know off the top of my head. I can get that for you because I had a sheet open this morning that told me what it was, but I don't remember
just
the dollar.
Just looking at option 4, like based on how much is there versus how much then would have to be funded.
You mean like new
financing? As far as the bond funding, I would recommend that we, if we do it with bond funding, we probably could evaluate at the time, but the majority of it would be bond funds.
Okay, so two questions to that. One, we've had before presentations by the Recycling Partnership that I know could assist, they have their grants available to help with both MRFs as well as with if you purchase carts for recycling, but specific, as well as the Mid-Missouri Solid Waste Management District, which we staff. Have we thought about some of those additional kind of grant opportunities rather than immediately going towards bonds?
Well, I know we looked at, go ahead with that. About the carts.
Yes, so we've had some preliminary discussions with the Recycling Partnership on potential grant funding. They have expressed interest in funding, partially funding both the carts, if we go to automated carts for recycling, and to fund some equipment in the new MRF. As I understand it, they will not fund like the entire building or portions of the entire building, but more they want to fund specific equipment in the MRF, like whatever optic sorters and that sort of stuff. So if we do proceed with design, once we start down the road, then we'll have some additional meetings with them and submit applications, work through the city's grant process to submit applications, and then come back with more details about what they are willing to fund and how much.
Yeah, because I look at the things like when we're doing the RFP for an engineering services, and I think one of the things that we can put in the RFP is to come with us with some of these alternative financing methods that will help reduce it for the cost to our rates. And I say for both of these things, so the Mid-Missouri Solid Waste Management District, we already pay towards it, right? The city, the community does, the state does. And the Recycling Partnership, for those of you who didn't have a chance to look at the report I sent on, like they're funded by like the Beverage Association, right? So they're the reason why we have so many cans and plastic things to recycle. So I think get some money back from them for it and utilize it to bring down our own cost. So I just wanted to see that one. Other questions for staff on the MRF? Yeah, Nick Foster.
I'm wondering a little bit about future needs and I don't think that there has been, with either option three or four, specifics about how large a facility we're talking about building there. And I'm also thinking about the way that technology is changing, or we can anticipate that it would change, and the opportunities to recycle other materials in future years. So I guess I'm wondering about the size of option three versus option four, and are considering the hybrid, and what are the considerations in terms of future need? Also, just alongside that, the MRF itself, the building, I assume itself is sound so that we could simply expand it?
And that would be part of what they would need to do with the RFP, as part of it, do an analysis of the existing building to make certain what portions of it could be utilized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the building structure itself sound. I think it needs complete new outside, new roof, new heating, such as that.
And so in terms of the size of a MRF that we're going to end up with?
Both of these, and Steve, you can correct me if I'm wrong, both three and four increase the capacity for, based on future predictions that RRT had for containers and fiber.
Okay.
I mean, we don't have enough room in the current one right now for the stuff that we collect. No,
it would be an increase in size, but hopefully with more modern equipment, optical sorters such as that, the footprint wouldn't necessarily have to be increased proportionally if the equipment is, what's the term I'm looking for?
Efficient?
Yes, efficient.
Always glad to help an engineer with that kind of
technical terms.
Yeah.
The other thing is that as we're talking about this holistic evolution of our recycling system, is that if we are switching the method of which we're collecting, and the potential of like this, you know, voluntary versus mandatory, whatever it is that we have out there, sizing the system, to your point, sizing the system for also the increase that we might expect to see that's going to be tricky. So we're putting out this RFP for data that's incomplete. And I guess I just know, you know what, the confidence that we would have in the increase of materials they might expect to collect. Because you have all of your recommendations in the report are like, don't change residential yet until we have enough staff to collect it. You know what I mean? And this, so I'm just worried about the timing on this, because I think, doesn't it say our current MRF is less than 5 years left on it of life? Right. And some of those balers, maybe not even. So it's kind of getting us into the next conversation, but those are questions I'll have.
Weren't the capacities of RRT, wasn't that estimated with increased collections?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I
thought. So we feel confident in it? Okay.
Their numbers were based on increased participation, I believe.
Okay.
I didn't read the report again yesterday or today, but I
think 233
that
pages.
Has a growth for a certain number of years.
And is that in alignment with what the cap projects as being goals for the community? Because we're talking about a significant amount here. And as I read back through that again, I was struck by how much we're sending to the landfill that are recyclables and how much of that is food waste. A large amount in either case. So,
just for clarity, we currently bring in around between 12 and 13,000 tons a year at the MRF. Options three and four are sized to process around 23,000 tons annually.
Okay.
So
okay.
Quite a bit more, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Don, you had a question.
Yes, it kind of ties into Councilman Foster's as far as advancing technology. What would be the projected, anticipated lifespan of the new facility if we go with the hybrid option? 3 years, 5 years, 20 years?
Anytime we do a capital improvement like this, we're anticipating them to last 20 years. Now, some of the equipment, you know, if we go optical sorters and robotics and that sort of stuff, those particular pieces of equipment will have a shorter lifespan. Exactly what they will have is we don't know. I mean, we haven't had a facility like this, but certainly part of the design parameters we can give the consultant is to make sure that they design facilities that are going to last as long as we can, try to avoid those items that are not going to last very long.
Okay, thank you.
Nick Knuth.
Actually, Don took my question, but I'll just second his and kind of put it in the context for me of why it's important, and this goes kind of goes without saying, but it should be said, which is, you know, specifically when you're talking about bonding, right? I mean, you're talking about the public. You need to be able to ensure that that is a long-term investment and a return on that. Otherwise, kind of a hard thing to sell.
Yeah. Rachel?
And I'm also going to echo, I think, your concern as well is that, and the recycling report, you know, it said, yes, they were able to capture a sense of what the current volume is of recycling, but not really because, like you said, we see a lot that winds up in landfill, and because people didn't have the option to do the curbside recycling because it was suspended, they put it in their trash bag. They weren't able to make it to the site. So that's also my concern is that are we going to see a significant increase in recycling if we move to the automated curbside pickup? And is the current MRF going to be able to handle that? Like, so what's sort of the, if we were to do this, what's the timing of when things would come into play? I think is that's my biggest question and concern of making sure that we don't overwhelm the crumbling MRF and the workers and, you know, it's all part of a system, right? If you throw a hijink into one piece, that's it can the whole system can fall apart. So what's our sense of like timing on everything?
Well, if we were given direction to move forward with an RFP, we could probably have something ready to hit the street in, what, 2-3 months? But if we move forward with automated collections, that's going to take a minimum of a year or two to get staff sufficient to go ahead and move that direction, plus get trucks and roll carts and everything ordered. I think construction is probably going to be a 2-3 year process after the design is complete, and that'd probably take a year. So we're talking like 3 years to build a MRF, possibly 2 years to move to an automated collection system. Those are best estimates at the time without having more direction and getting more detailed on estimates.
And I think to echo that, some the conversation, right, it's about making these decisions now, right, because we know the demand is going to grow, we know the need is going to grow, and it's to do like the right decision now so that we have it in place, and we know it's going to take time, but I think that's going to be part of it. And I think what you're saying in this hybrid option is that we would still be able to we could potentially be switching to, you know, more efficient collection of mm-hmm. curbside collection, which, by the way, you can go ahead and spoil us with telling us that we're offering positions to people to start curbside recycling within the next month. But you can get to that in a moment. I think the conversation about getting people kind of used to the new system, even before the MRF might be finished, will the hybrid in construction in limbo MRF be able to handle that? That's kind of Rachel's point, because we might see an increase. And then the other thing that I think about with this is, I wanna ask the question, and I don't know who, Nick, you were probably here, like, how soon was the existing MRF too small by the time we opened it? You know, like how soon, I imagine that we built it, it maybe was working for, you know, 5, and then all of a sudden we kind of were outgrowing it already. And so there's that balance between over design for the future of it, but as you're starting to talk about expansion of materials like styrofoam or Tetra Paks or all these different materials that are out there, all of these things that are out there is like, how do we have, and I assume this is something that they will recommend to us, or whoever you put in will recommend to us the best option, and what is the average lifespan that we should be thinking about? I just threw a bunch at you.
Yeah, I'll throw Nick a little more. I wasn't around when the MRF was constructed the first time. One thing that struck me about the report is how rather consistently they talk about the level of support that there is for recycling in Columbia. And I was also struck by the fact that if we were to send our items using option one and option two, which you're not considering, if we did transport, we have to send them to Kansas City or St. Louis. So we're leading in this area in our part of the state, to be sure. I don't even have any idea where the next best place might be within the state to send that or out of the state. But In any regard, whatever we're going to do, there's going to be a significant capital outlay to get this done. And I don't know if you have an answer for this or not, but speaking to what Mr. Knuth said about the sale of this, we are looking at an increase in a rate increase there. Have you taken into consideration the sellability of this? And I mean, my own suspicion is that the community would be supportive, but it is going to be a significant outlay of funds. Make it happen, no matter
at this point, that's not been, we haven't done any work on that. I will tell you that all the bonds that have ever been issued for solid waste have either been through the internal loan fund, whatever that actual term is, or it's been through special obligation bonds, and they were sold with council authorization.
Yeah, Betsy.
I would think maybe by the time we get to the point where we would need to ask people for bonds and to raise the rates, hopefully we'll have things under control. We will have gone to automated trash collection and hopefully automated recycling. And people will not be quite so annoyed because things will be working better. So we might be an easier sell than it would be today.
They want to see a delivery on the services that we're having. Yeah.
I think they deserve that.
Any other questions for staff on this one? So your direction that you're needing from us is whether or not we're comfortable with the proceeding with the issuing of the RFP for, you call it a between 3 and 4, I don't know what direction you need from us. And I don't want us to get into the, well, no, I want this baler, not that one. So that's not our level.
It's basically, I think what we're looking at there is not building a brand new facility somewhere else on the site, but let's look first at the potential for expanding our current facility, keeping it in operation during the expansion, and then repurposing the other portion for these other types of materials that we currently don't process that people could bring in and drop off, such as styrofoam, mattresses, electronics, and make a household hazardous waste collection location out of it.
So are you asking, are you going to ask for them to kind of show us both options? Because you mentioned when you talked about option 4 that you thought that price was higher than it should have been. So mm-hmm. are you going to ask them for either an expansion on our existing or a new at the same
set? Okay. Or some hybrid between the two. Yes.
Okay. Betsy, were you going to ask a question?
I would sort of aim for a new building, having been in your old building.
when it's finished.
It would be nice to repurpose that, but I think you might, it might be nice to see what a new building at state of the art could do for the community and maybe the surrounding community. That's just my.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking about just sort of sustainability isn't quite the right word, but, you know, yes, expanding, but then are we staying with existing, essentially the existing carbon footprint of that building
embodied
versus
energy.
Building a new one that could be way more energy efficient? I don't know what the trade-off is there because that's not my understanding. I don't know how that works.
They could do that calculation in the RFP to show us what
was
the carbon footprint.
That would be great to sort of see, like, can you build something that is going to just sort of in the long run pay off from the amount of the carbon footprint that it produces, the ability to either be upgraded in the future if we see a significant increase in recycling, and, you know, able to be then adjusted as new technologies emerge, all of that. You know, I'm thinking about flexibility because it seems like our current one just kind of
is
head bit the dust. Yeah.
Well, and to that point, I think we have kind of our own plans for reducing the carbon footprint of our city facilities. And so however it can capture waste heat for heating and cooling the building, materials it's used, obviously, and comfort and space of the employees who are working in the space. Yeah. Okay. Is there any concerns with them proceeding with, and obviously we'll hear back on this one before the things come with RFP for between? Okay. All right, moving on.
Okay, curbside collections. One of the recommendations that came out of their report from RT was that we implement an automated collection of curbside recycling with kind of a different program. We would collect containers that are placed in a plastic bag and loose fiber all in one cart. So instead of having a cart for fiber and a cart for containers, we'd have one cart, you'd put all the stuff in it, and then that would be the first step of separation at the MRF, would be to separate the two. Now, we discontinued collecting glass at the curb and instead put the purple drop-off bins at recycling drop-off centers, because the glass going through the process of being collected at the curb and it gets smashed and broken into small pieces, and they like big pieces that are color identifiable by machines, and they will not take the glass that we pick up at curbside. We can't find a vendor for it. But when we put the purple bins out, we have it at one or two sites. At two drop-off sites, they will take that glass from us and recycle it. And then they also recommended that we get some specialized services to create the most efficient collection routes using computer software. So that's something, if we moved automated collections, we could look into. So we are recommending that we consider going to an automated recycling collection in the future. We don't think we should change this until we have been able to successfully bring back the residential curbside recycling and that we get our staffing in solid waste to at least 90%.
Would you like to pause there and talk to us about the current status of recycling collection curbside?
Yeah. I think the last time we brought this up, we had 18 refuse collector vacancies. At this point in time, we have 16. We have three people scheduled to start next week. And then we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 additional people that are in process of either getting a background check, the CDL drug test, or the medical physical that could likely be offered permanent. Not a no longer conditional offer, but a final offer of employment that could be starting in the near future.
And so I wanted to make sure you said that 7, they are in conditional offer status.
Yes, they still have to complete have a to physical through, or right, background check or whatever.
They've passed enough that we've said you're on the list for now to do the background check and make sure they have their drug test, et cetera, et cetera.
And so they're in process. And hopefully the results will come back well, and they will accept the final offer, and then we'll be able to get some more people on board in the near future. If we get all these folks on board, we get them trained, sometime at the end of next month, we would hopefully be able to stand that back up. On whether it's going to be every week or every other week initially, we don't know yet.
So where would that put us in terms of the percentage of staffing?
16, and then we got 13, so we'd still have 6 vacancies. So wouldn't get us to 90%, but we'd be getting close.
Close to 90%.
Rachel and then Nick.
I don't know if I missed it. Did you say we'd come back every other week or weekly?
I'm thinking every other week initially. Just because we still will be short and still be reliant on the temporary staffing agency.
Where you're like trading off the different routes. Okay.
Or red or green, I mean. I think it was. Yeah, Nick, no.
Two questions. What is this current staffing level percentage-wise?
Percentage-wise, I don't know. We got 18 vacancies. And do you know, Kathy, off the top of your head, what our total is?
Sorry, 42 out of 59 filled? Okay.
71%. Okay.
And it was my second question. For those few that are in the pipeline to employment with us, what's the success rate there in terms of passing through those final checks? I know that can be a hurdle. I'm not looking for, exactly, but just in your experience.
I have never tracked that, so I don't have a good feel off the top of my head to say half or whatever.
Kathy Baker, would you like to come to the microphone?
Well, Good evening, Council and Mayor. So I actually had staff do some reviewing of recent hires for refuse collectors. And I think I need to first explain the multiple steps. And just to give you an idea, it's not that we just interview and we can immediately hire them. So we always have to post our jobs by ordinance for a minimum of 10 days. Then we usually give applicants at least a week's notice before we interview them, so that if they have a current job, that gives them time to make arrangements to take off work. For a refuse collector, you not only do an interview, but you have a performance test so that you can show that you have the skills to drive a commercial vehicle. So we have a selection process. Once that process is over, that's all scored. Those that achieve the required score make the eligibility roster, which means they can be considered for hire. If they do not make the eligibility roster, they're no longer under consideration at that point. So at that point, the department can choose which applicants they would like to move forward in the process, make a conditional offer. Then we have to conduct a commercial driving drug test, a federal drug test is what that is called, and those generally take at least 3 business days to get the results back. Now, I will tell you, this past week, because of specimens getting transported due to the weather, there's been some delay in results because there's been some delays in travel and getting those to the labs, but generally you can expect about a 3 business day turnaround. However, if there is anything in the drug test that is unusual, the medical review officer has 3 business days to try and get in contact with that applicant to determine if there's a prescription or some type of other thing that could cause the unusual results. So you have about a 3 to 6 business day for that federal drug test result. Then we have to do 2 types of background checks. We have to do your normal criminal and driving background check, but then we have to do what's called the Federal Motor Carry Safety Administration check, which is checking to see if they've had a positive drug test at a previous employer where they use their commercial driver's license, and we're required to do that. And that's FMCSA is the acronym for that, and it's much easier to say. That is very quick. As long as we get all of the information from the applicant, they have to go in and provide an electronic consent for us to do that check. So there can be a delay with the applicant giving us the consent. Then we have to have the applicant fill out the form to authorize us to do the criminal and driving check. And that can take a lot of time if they have lived in some place other than Missouri. Every state, in some cases, some states, it's every county, has their own requirements for how quickly they respond to that. And I can give you an example. In the state of California, you have to go to every single county to get that data, and we have a third party that does that for us. The state of Illinois, they have up to 30 days to respond to a criminal history. So that varies greatly based on what the Social Security check shows, because that's what they base it off, right? They run a Social Security number, and that tells them which states and which counties they need to request information. So there's some varies in significantly on the criminal portion of it. And then we have to do a medical physical, which is really pretty quick. We're able to get them in usually with a local provider within 3 business days, and if they pass everything, we usually know in 1 to 2 business days. If they have an underlying medical condition, we may have to wait until they get the required medical records. And so sometimes there's a delay of up to a week for it. But I have an example. I give you all of that so then I can give you an example how it can go fast or it can go quickly.
As well as average or median, mean those sort of numbers.
Yeah, and I'm giving you the averages on how long it takes to get the different steps, but it can really go anywhere from, and I'm talking from the date we say they're a finalist to when we actually make an offer, can be anywhere from 18 to 30 days. That's the time frame you're looking at. If the applicant has to give 2 weeks notice to their employer, that delays the start date. So I think if you're looking at averages of when we selected a finalist to when we can make a final offer, you're looking at that 18 to 30 day time frame. Their actual start date may be delayed from that.
And I have so are any of these, you said a lot, you know, when we're talking about commercial or federal requirements on this. So there's nothing, I know that we kind of changed after marijuana, recreational adult use marijuana was passed, we changed some of our rules about the background drug test. Are any of those You know, are there any things that we have done that this is not reflecting? I guess I'm wondering how much, when you mentioned, you know, we, one of them is they get a if they failed a drug test in another place. If it's for a reason that we would allow, if it was in the, you know, is there?
Not with the, federal. So if they, for federal jobs that require a federal drug test, if a applicant or an employee tests positive, they have to complete a federal return to duty program. There are very specific requirements that they have to meet in order for us to be eligible. So part of that FMCSA clearinghouse is, did you have a positive drug test? If you did, are you prohibited or not prohibited? Well, that's the results we get. You're a prohibited driver or you're a not prohibited driver. You can have had a positive drug test and completed the required federal return to duty program and not be prohibited. But there are certain things that the employee and or applicant have to complete in order to be eligible to drive in a job that requires a commercial driver's license. One of the things that we did change this fiscal year is previously we required a negative drug test before we made a conditional offer. We have changed that where we're making the conditional offer and then we're doing the drug test and the physical and all of those other background checks in a hope that that would maybe expedite processes. In some areas it has, but the removal of marijuana, which was part of your question, has no effect on jobs that require a commercial driver's license.
That's what I thought. I just couldn't remember. I knew we had that conversation during part of our
Yeah, we're subject to the federal regulations.
Okay. Other questions for Kathy on staffing? So you said on average from conditional offer or eligibility roster.
I would say interview for when they select a finalist. So after you've interviewed and we have a roster. So when the department says, this is the applicant, we want to move forward. To when we actually make the offer, it's averaging 18 to 30 days.
Okay.
And some of that's reliant on how quickly the applicant responds to us as well.
Right. I guess one other just follow-up I have on that, do we communicate this, all of these things and the potential time it might take? Because I imagine we probably have some who then find another job while they're in waiting period.
Potentially. So as far as communication, so for all permanent positions, an HR, a professional HR staff member participates in every single one of those interview process. Their job is to be that coordinator and to communicate to the applicants what the steps are, where they are in the process. That doesn't mean that they can't have contact with the department, but that's our primary role, is to make sure that we're meeting all the requirements for the job, that we're communicating with the applicant, no matter what the outcome is. If they get offered the job, it's the supervisor that gets to call them and say, hey, congratulations, we'd like to offer you a job. But we're communicating the different steps in the process with them.
Because I have heard feedback from people who have applied, and it might not be in solid waste, but others, about like they kind of have gotten and then they're like waiting and they have, it's like crickets. So just wondering if maybe we could get into the practice of like the weekly kind of check in, like, hey, it's still, you're still on, you know what I mean? This is still in process, just so it's not like, why haven't I heard anything? Because I know some of it is because they have to go through all of this and they might not know how long that takes and they might not be as up on our process.
It also could be temporary selection process for temporary positions are very different. HR has the application portal that we collect the applications, but all of that is handled by the departments as far as when do they contact the applicants, when they schedule the interviews. So HR is not a touch point for temporary positions. So I don't, when you've heard those concerns, I'm not sure if they're a temporary position or a permanent position. It's very common for us to say, unless we know it's going to be quicker or it's going to be delayed, for us to say you will hear something within 2 weeks is generally what we tell applicants, unless we know there's going to be a delay like the holidays or the supervisor's getting ready to go on vacation or something like that.
How are applicants communicated with?
By email, generally. We do, if we're going to invite them for an interview, staff calls and leaves a message, and then they follow up with an email. And if they're selected for the position or a finalist, that is usually by phone. And then if they're not selected, it's generally by email. Unless the applicant would call us, we would obviously speak to them by phone.
Other questions? Yeah, Don.
Under the premise of process improvement, the processes within this hiring that are within our control, how often do we review those to see where those can be simplified / streamlined?
So every time we're opening a position, an HR staff member is assigned to work on that process with the department. And we talk with the department to see if there's anything they want to change. It's very much a collaboration. It is not an HR-driven process, other than we make sure we meet all of the requirements that we are required to by city ordinance or other regulations. There's always ongoing conversations with the supervisors on, you know, what's working well, do we want to do something different, some things we can change, some things we can't, like the federal regulations and the time it takes to get that information. Now, I will say HR is just like the rest of our departments. We have been short-staffed, and we're struggling to keep up with our volume as well.
Yeah, I think for some of it, it's like, what can we automate? Even getting a bot from IT telling me you're still in the process, you know, whatever the system could do, I think can go a long way. And the feedback I heard, it wasn't temporary ones, it was full time. And it was across the board, right? It wasn't just one utility or one department over another. So, yeah. Other questions for Kathy while she's there? Thank you. Okay, so we're at 71%. So we're not going automated collection recycling this week.
No, not this week. Okay. But that we are recommending that we consider going to residential, automated residential curbside recycling. But we do need to have our staffing up to where we have enough staff that it's not subject to, oh, we're going to have to scale back again. So some things we would like some feedback on is, you know, do we go to automated collections once we're at that 90% staffing level? And if we do we do a weekly or biweekly? And do we have mandatory participation, which means we give every residential customer a recycling cart? Or do we do voluntary participation, which is what we have today? You don't have to recycle. You can if you choose to. We've kind of estimated the costs on there for mandatory participation, and we need about $2 million to purchase 36,000 carts, and then to lease 10 or 12 trucks would be $560,000 to $800,000 a year. If we did voluntary participation, the cart cost would be dropped by about $700,000, and the annual lease cost would go down to $400,000 to $450,000 a year.
Yeah, Rachel.
Just to clarify, so all curbside refuse and recycling customers pay the same monthly, so everybody pays. I mean, right now we have different rates for depending on your solid waste bin, but even if you were to do a voluntary system, would everybody still then pay the same rate, or would people that volunteer into doing recycling pay more? I'm confused.
That's a question on here, is that okay. Do all the curbside refuse and recycling customers pay the same monthly rate? Okay. Currently, we have a rate for refuse collection. And it's...
Whether or not you recycle.
Yeah, it's correct. 17, what is it, 30?
17, 37.
37 a month. When we switch to carts, there'll be three different rates depending on your cart size for your refuse.
And what you're saying is that whatever they're paying currently per refuse cart, they would just continue to pay. It would not be an increase over recycling.
Well, that's a question. Would we?
Well, I guess we're saying that's not a question on here. It's a statement. And so we're asking you to clarify the statement.
I guess my clarification is, would the council prefer that we maintain just a consistent rate like we have now and leave the program voluntary? Which is what I would recommend personally.
So in mandatory, we need to unpack that a little bit more. Like mandatory, does that mean that means everyone gets a recycling cart, but does it also mean whether or not they use it, right? So mandatory just means everyone gets a cart.
Everybody gets a cart.
It's not like you're going to look in their trash cart and see if there's recycling in there.
And so I don't believe that that's the best route to go, because I think you'll have a lot of carts out there that people just won't be using. I think it's if you want the cart, call us up, we'll get you the cart, and then you participate.
In other cities that have made this switch, I remember Lawrence did it like 10 years ago. I point that out specifically. yeah, the Jayhawks did it like 10 years ago. And when they did theirs, like I think the carts just showed up at everybody's house.
Yes.
But was theirs voluntary or mandatory?
So I've been in two communities that have moved to automated systems, including automated recycling. And we just gave everybody a cart. And they chose whether to use it or not use it. So it was provided, and it was still voluntary, but everything was provided, both the cart for refuse and the cart for recycling.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about, yeah, logistically,
because
it almost gets more confusing to have.
Try to pick and choose who's doing what. It's easier just to just provide the cart and it's used or not used.
Well, and right now we respond to community members when they ask us, can I have my money back because you're not picking up my recycling? Your cost of recycling is included in the refuse pickup that we have. You know, it's included in all these different costs that we have. So my question then would be, how could I justify that response to somebody if it wasn't?
Correct.
So to me, while I understand there's the potential of ones not used, I think it actually becomes a lot harder for the system if you don't have it. Yeah. Nick.
I'm definitely on the side of making it voluntary, both for the cost savings. That's honestly my biggest reason. I mean, you can't, I just hate to buy an extra 10,000 carts that don't get used and then help offset the cost of the transition.
There's also the truck leasing.
Right.
So,
You know, to your point, Barbara, about, you know, justifying that cost, I see it as the option's there. I mean, you can
sign up or not.
Right, like,
yeah,
we'll bring you a cart.
Yeah.
And the recycling facilities for drop-off will still exist. They'll still need maintenance.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think my other kind of question on it, too, is that when we have, you know, asking people to sign up for a thing, it's kind of like our programs for energy efficiency, right? We have all these programs, but how many people don't even know that we have them unless we are doing like door-to-door telling about this? And so I think about this sort of thing where it's the logistics of rolling it out and getting people to sign up for it. We'll probably have the early adopters who are waiting for this and can't wait. Nick Foster is one. And then for those who actually, this would make a huge difference in the size of their trash cart, the reducing of it and the opportunities that they have, that but they just might not be watching a council meeting work session to know about the option to do this. Yeah, Rachel.
I think about it being sort of a passive versus an active system, if you will. So you give everybody a cart, like it shows up. So people who may not have either volunteered, didn't know, whatever, they already have a cart sitting there. We have actively done something versus just saying, here we have these carts, you come to us and request one, is a very passive system in a way.
Right.
And most research tells us that active systems do much better in that regard.
Yeah, Nick Foster.
Well, I'm thinking over and over about how we really need more education to take place in the community about all of this. And when you, for instance, I think, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, that about 37% of what goes into the landfill is food waste. I mean, that's a massive amount. And composting makes a big difference in what people throw out and what ends up in the landfill. So with all of this, I think education is going to have to be a part of what we're talking about. And the goal in mind is to reduce the amount that we're sending to the landfill, whether that's because we're increasing the recycling, we're doing more composting, or whatever it is. People are learning to reuse what they have, but that's going to be an educational challenge, and that's challenging. it just is. But I think to get where we want to go, it's going to require that educational component. And just about weekly or biweekly, I would imagine you'd start biweekly, and if we're able to move to weekly and the demand is there, then
right.
We would. But
I think that would be the goal, is to start biweekly, and then if we get to the point where it makes sense to move to weekly, then we would.
And based on the first checkbox up here, I mean, we're kind of giving input or asking the questions to show kind of what our thoughts are. But at this time, we're not needing to make this conversation because we're not ready yet? Or, I mean, what feedback do we need here?
Well, if you wanted to give us some direction to proceed when we get to 90%, we would already know what to put together, because we can go ahead and get a program prepared, but I mean, we can wait till we're closer to the 90% and then come back to council with a proposal.
I think I would wait till we're at 90%. That's a pretty high goal for us, or for our solid waste department. I mean, seriously, we haven't been there for a long time, and 90% still requires us to have other people working, not just our city staff. So,
I think my biggest concern is how often are we at 100%, 90% for refuse collection? You know, I mean, we've been historically 86% turnover. I mean, like, so when I'm thinking about this, it's not a bad idea for us to be doing the planning and coming up with the cost of those. Again, I'll ask the question, when we talk about the cost of the project, I would ask, what are our options out there for offsetting this rather than just our own budget item putting this in, but what grants are available? Is this number including where the money would come from as far as recycling partnership or solid waste? Those are the things that I would want to know as far as the offsetting, because to Rachel's point, if I want people to participate, I have to make it really easy to participate. And kind of take out some of the voluntary aspects to it. And then the other question I have is, we've gotten into a lot of conversation about switching to automated collection in the first place. So when I see the suggestion to have a 95-gallon on here, and I imagine the conversations I had just to get people okay with, you know, a 20, a 30, you know, that raises some questions I would have. Especially because if the idea is because we have bigger things to fit in, like a big box, then I don't know if I want to design my system based on the occasional big box I might have to recycle. Yeah, Don.
If we move to automated, what would be, if any, the anticipated reduction in staffing required? In other words, if we say, let's go automated, would we get to 90%? Quicker.
So currently in residential curbside recycling, there's 10 FTE budgeted positions.
Okay.
Depending on whether we went with the everybody gets a cart or whether it's voluntary, we would be possible to operate with somewhere between 6 to 9. So we're talking about 1 to maybe 4 less people required.
So the 6 would be based on the voluntary with a lower number?
With the lower number of trucks, yes.
And obviously that's not eliminating any current person or current position, no, because we have enough vacancies right now.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, Betsy.
One of the recommendations, and you just brought this up again, if we do voluntary recycling, is, I guess, different routes. Would you really have different routes if you have recycling separate from our trash collection?
The recycling routes are different than the trash routes now. They're collected the same day of the week, but the routes are different based on who's participating.
Is there 4 recycling routes and 8 trash routes or something like that?
5 recycling routes and 8 if we are collecting trash every week,
yeah,
on recycling. And when we're doing every other week, we were running 3 routes a day.
8 trash routes every day, 5 recycling weekly, 3 on biweekly. So same area, just they're configured differently. So the recycling routes cover a much bigger area because there's less people putting out stuff versus trash.
And for going on this too, I think just to kind of come towards our bottom 2 options, the recycling bags. So if we were to do the collection, which would have a dual system, so fibers and containers, but separately bagged in the same cart, what would people be, if we're eliminating the blue bags, what would they be putting their containers in? Just whatever they wanted?
Yes, whatever, you know, white kitchen trash bag or black trash bag. But okay. They could buy blue bags at the store, whatever bag they chose.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify on that one. And do the trucks have the ability, is it still going to be a dual hopper system?
No.
Or a single?
It'd be a single. It'd be the same truck as what we've got now for refuse.
Okay. So I mean, I don't think we have consensus on the voluntary or mandatory. I especially have the questions about the additional funding options because I know for some of those there's restrictions. And if you have a voluntary once a month or every, you know what I mean? Like they don't give you as much grant money for that because it's not as active. So I'd be interested in us exploring what the options are for those.
I also add, so in addition to additional options, are there additional options for, I may not get a little flack for this, but increasing rates cover some of the additional costs for recycling?
Are you saying this because you're not?
What?
No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I've lived other places where rates are way higher than we pay here. So, and the rates have stayed fairly consistent over time. So just toss that in there as well. So, I mean, if it's like a dollar, you know, I could see that going over more favorably than like $20, obviously, right. But is there a little trade-off there?
I think we need to get back to like consistent service that is reliable and safe and clean for the employees before I want to have more conversation. You know, just be, I want to make sure that we're delivering right on what we have. But I do, to your point, understanding, are we, is the value, are we actually, you know, I don't think on any of our utilities we're adequately probably covering. We try to do a cost of service to make sure that we're consistent, but we're probably always doing more than on some. That's a good point.
Saying that more eloquently than I did.
No, I didn't. let's see. What's your... So I think probably going forward is we obviously want you to still be looking at what are our options for this. To Don's point, you know, we can probably start exploring it sooner than the 90% because we also don't know what if that's a from my perspective, are we ever going to hit 90%? Or will a safer way to pick up recycling make it a more attractive job for people to apply for? So for me, it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg. If you're telling me I'm jumping off a truck 1,100 times a day on a recycling route, I might wait until I'm driving a truck and you're just using a joystick to pick up a cart. So, yeah, Nick Foster.
Just the 90%, where are we in terms of, I know that there are different departments and there are different needs and so forth, and but where are we in terms of overall staffing with the city? Are we at 75%, 80%, 85%?
Wait, you would ask the hard question at the
Kathy's like,
discussion.
Kathy's going to do some math. And then I would just add, I forgot to comment when you were talking about it on the MRF one and on this. I would wholeheartedly support removing glass from a curbside recycling. And I've stopped doing my curbside glass. I've done it to the drop-offs for the last 5 years since we started doing the purple because of just the safety for employees. Like the number one for me was safety for employees when they're picking up the glass, the chances of it breaking, it getting into the system. The report that you shared, the percentage of contamination from recycling of glass in all the other products alone brings down the value for them. So you're seeing a lot of communities are going away from having glass as a curbside collection and just doing it as the drop-offs because then we can keep it together and keep it clean where it can then make fiberglass insulation and other products.
One of our more valuable exports too, so.
Yeah. Do you need any other direction on this one?
I do not believe we do.
Okay. Oh, yes. So on average, the city workforce is 17% vacant for, like, I'm assuming full-time.
Yeah, it's not.
Right now.
Right. I meant average across departments.
Yeah.
Okay. next slide? Or did we move? And I moved it. Okay.
Next topic is recycling drop-off centers. RRT recommends that we close 3 recycling drop-off sites. They said they aren't serving their intended function, and they consume our resources without contributing to the recycling effort. And the 3 sites are the one downtown at 10th and Cherry, the one on the University of Missouri campus along Kentucky Boulevard, and the one on the University campus near East Campus Road and Ashland Road. And they've also recommended that we improve some of the sites that we have, that we consolidate sites, that we actually provide staffed sites that are fenced and have established operating hours. And so we believe that we would be wise to consolidate the state, our South Providence Road and the State Farm Parkway sites, and then to relocate or upgrade the site at Cosmo Park, which is at Parks Management. And one of the things RRT suggested was that maybe we relocate it and consolidate it with the yard waste drop-off center on Parkside Drive. This is showing the facilities at Cosmo Park, and then this is the facilities at State Farm Parkway and Providence Road. We believe it'd be a good idea to actually reduce the overall number of recycling drop-off centers we have after we have curbside collections back in place, and to staff it. And then we could give residents more opportunity to possibly expand some of the products that we do recycle, where we could have it staffed, where we could make certain that the styrofoam's put in the right container, the mattresses are put in the right container, or electronics are put in the right place, that, you know, boxes are broken down and such as that. Because if we actually get curbside back up and running, we wouldn't theoretically need as many drop-off sites. And if it was staffed, our quality of product would go up considerably. The contamination would go down. And there again, we're recommending that we don't make these changes until we get our residential curbside recycling resumed and we get our staffing up to at least 90%. And then we think we ought to evaluate the Parks Management facility and the one on State Farm Parkway and fence them and staff them. And the reasons that we believe we need to fence and staff these sites is because this is the kind of thing we experienced last week when we weren't servicing them because of the frigid temperatures, trying to keep staff safe by not making them go out there and pick this stuff up off the ground when it's below zero. And then you go back to 2020 and we had the same thing. They're unmanageable as they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And quick clarification, the one of the ones that they're recommending not having is one of our downtown, and isn't that a location of the solid waste district of downtown? So, like, aren't they paying for that location of recycling? As far as, you know how we have a few, like, drop-off, like, dumpsters of recycling in downtown that downtown businesses pay for via the so it's the central business. I don't know what we call their solid waste district, but
there again, downtown in the CID, we've got some containers in different locations, but there's no additional charges for recycling in the CID. They pay a single rate depending on the type of business that they are for both refuse and recycling.
Right, but I assume we'd have to replace those in that vicinity. I mean, you've got multiple bars.
We'd have to replace probably some containers for the businesses to use, but we wouldn't have the drop-off location any longer.
I would just want to be mindful of that because, especially as we've had alleyways closed off, that them not able to access recycling locations, and we want them to recycle, to be cautious over that. Nick Foster, and then Don, I think you had your hand up too.
I like the idea of staffing these drop-off centers. I'm wondering if we're able to increase the quality of what we're taking in as a result, would there be also an increase in anticipated revenues for selling these items if we've got a more, well, I don't want to say pure, but a cleaner product in order to...
Well, we'd have a cleaner product, but what we would have is we would be transporting less material to the MRF and then separating it out and transporting it to the landfill.
So I'm wondering about what the positive revenue impact of that might be. If we're talking about staffing, we're talking about additional
costs
there. So is there a benefit on the other side fiscally? Are we better able to sell the products that we have? Do we spend less time? We obviously spend less time, so there should be a cost savings.
Yeah, I don't
there
know if separating everything more out. Efficient in the operation of the MRF to have a cleaner product. There'd be a lot less work for staff to do to get it sorted.
Yeah, I don't know if you can give you a dollar amount on.
I wouldn't expect
what that would increase, but the efficiency would be most important. The other part is that you will have a cleaner product, so it would make it easier for you to go out and try to sell.
Don, you had a question.
A couple, but one kind of, let me piggyback off of Mr. Foster here right quick. We should be able to, I'm thinking, know what we're doing today as far as what revenue we're able to generate from the sale of the recyclable materials. I understand we may not be able to identify quickly what the improvements would be with the cleaner inflow, but we ought to at least be able to tell us what we're generating today.
Yes.
So I think that would be of interest. Kind of circles back to the MRF as well as the new one. You know, what can we generate out of that to help pay for it? The other one, I know we're looking at trying to close some of these, especially if we're looking at staffing. I get a continual request to actually add one somewhere along the Scott Boulevard corridor, get it, you know, away from the central city. Resumption of curbside would help with that, but still, especially if we're looking at removing glass and we're asking people to drop it off, then again, more decentralized locations for those drop-offs for glass, I think would encourage that rather than throwing it in the trash. Thank you.
Okay.
And then we've got Rachel and then Nick Knoth.
I do want to be mindful, too. I know that you all don't have all the data in terms of the amount that actually is recycled because so much over the last several years has wound up in the landfill because we did not have curbside recycling. So I understand that those numbers may be a little off. I just want to recognize that. And I think this makes our task a little bit difficult too. And we don't quite know, like we can see from these pictures that people want to recycle. I'll also echo, you know, because we drive down Scott all the time. And just looking at that map, there's nothing in that corner. So my question would be, because this would come after implementing automated, these changes would come after implementing automated collection and once we have appropriate staffing, correct? You know, closing some facilities and then moving to staff facilities. For the commingled recyclables, the containers, would those no longer need to be in a blue bag at those sites? Or because I know one of the things in one of the questions was, do we do away with the blue bags?
I mean, you wouldn't have to put the containers in a
would
bag.
Would it still need to be in a bag?
To drop them off at the drop-off site, they wouldn't have to be in a bag.
Like container?
Yep. No. You
right.
can take
so,
a bucket of cans and dump it in the container today.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and I think, like, as we're having these conversations, it's about more than just putting a bigger fence up around this existing site. It's more about what should a drop-off site look like?
Correct.
And in these communities that have staffed ones, I think about Iowa City, where they have staffed, you know, sites that also maybe they have a building there that's like an educational center for people to utilize for meetings or for how to recycle or compost. They have it even more individualized. It's not just containers. It's like aluminum, you know, plastic. Like they have those separated out too, which I think, to your point, makes a cleaner product when it comes time for selling it. So I think rather than just imagining, think like we'll just combine these, and it's more of like what actually will help us with our end goal, which is reducing the amount of valuable resources that we are literally throwing away in a hole in the ground. So, sorry, Nick Knoth, I didn't mean to jump in there.
Oh, but. You're good. So to reiterate something that has been said, so we're talking about these upgrades, these improvements, the staffing, et cetera. would be post reaching staffing level 90% or more and curbside recycling collection resuming in some capacity.
Correct.
Is...
Oh, hold on.
Sorry.
So,
let him...
Sorry. You know, one nick at a time.
That's all anybody can manage.
It seems to me that the demand for the extremely high demand for these drop-off centers is because of the lack of curbside recycling, right? And that we didn't have some of these issues that we do now. And so I'm curious, do we, improvements, yes, but will we need staffing at these centers if we're, have resumed curbside recycling?
Yes, because yes. even when we were still picking up residential recycling, we were still having abuse at these sites, and you were still having days where it would overflow and you would have to send through two or three trucks out to clean it up. So there's a need to make sure that it's staffed, and that we can make sure that people aren't just dropping off. The other thing is you have people that'll drop off refrigerators and stoves and all these other things that are not part of our recyclables, but it's just a place to dump stuff. Right. And so having it where it's staffed will prevent that from occurring.
That answers my question. My second question then, on the operating hours, one, it is less of a question, more of a concern, that we be very careful and mindful about setting those hours to ensure they're accessible.
Yes.
Because people go all hours now, whether it's, you know, because they're working third shift or whatever. I doubt that anyone was thinking 9 to 5, but just being cognizant of, you know, all the types of hours people work in our community and being as accessible as possible as a service that we are providing.
That would be our goal.
All right, and I'm mindful that we're on slide 11 of 22, and I'm just keeping an eye on our time. There's more to this. And then it's fine. You had a continuing question. I don't want to cut you off, other Nick.
Thank you. I don't feel confined at all by your referencing the time. there are a couple of ways that they present next steps and timeline. And in the immediate near term, they suggest, first addressing safety concerns, which I think you've already done.
We did that as soon as they were identified.
Yeah. But to go ahead and close the three drop-off centers, add glass-only bins, and evaluate the routing of collection routes. Over the next 6 months is creating staff a recycling coordinator position. So I don't know if you speak to that, and I've looked through your slides, but I can't recall if that's a part of it. So we're talking again about staffing here.
And my next slide actually talks about improving our education and outreach programs to promote recycling and provide educations for classrooms, community groups, et cetera. And one proposal here is to hire a new staff person in the role of recycling coordinator. And then as part of this whole MRF upgrade and repurpose possibly the old building and have the household hazardous waste and a recycling drop-off would be doing what they're calling a community environmental center at the landfill that would function as a one-stop shop for residents for recyclable household hazardous waste, other wastes that we may begin to start processing. And then they could also focus on increasing recycling of cardboard, which was recommended in that study. So we recommend that we do include a recycling coordinator position in the annual budget for FY 2026.
So their recommendations is to do it right now, like in the report, you know, and I understand like cost of these things, but I just think about the call. And so is the idea then you can utilize other staff in the meantime? Because I mean, obviously I know we have environmental educators, and from my previous experience, you can have a coordinator, but you have to actually utilize the coordinator and take their advice or work with them to get the program's improvements out there. So I guess when we're talking about fiscal year 26, that's in 2 years, we're talking about. Unless you meant 25.
No, I think they probably meant 26. I think the idea would be to... Because there's a lot of planning that needs to be put in effect in order to start all this processes. And so it's like what comes first, the chicken or the egg. And so I agree with our existing staff, we can start doing some of the education on recycling to kind of help people understand why it's important to recycle and what does that look like. I mean, we have our sustainability crew right there, and we have the, so we have the process to start that process now.
Well, and we are. I mean, I get the newsletter, you know what I mean, that talks about the ways to do, but I guess it's more of that, like,
I think
making a priority.
Right, and I think as we look at trying to decide whether or not we're going to, I think bring back curbside recycling is probably the key, and that's probably one of the first things we need to do. Deciding what we're going to do with the MRF is kind of that next step, and then how do we deal with all the recycling centers, and what's the staffing level that's needed to do all of those things. And so there's a larger analysis that needs to be brought forward. I think what we're looking for today is conversations on exactly how do you guys want to see us move forward, and do we want to see curbside recycling, which I'm sure we do.
I speak for the council on this one.
Do we want to update our MRF to make it more user-friendly, so instead of having something that's manually sorted, that we actually have something that's automatically resorted? And there's those technologies that communities have embraced a couple of decades ago that we're chasing ourselves to kind of get to. And
like the wheel?
Yes, ma'am. And so I think there's a lot of those nuances that we have to put in place. And whether we hire a recycling coordinator in the 25 budget or the 26 budget, the idea is that we do need to make sure that education is part of our efforts in order to communicate with our residents.
And I think, we talked about outreach on a lot of these conversations. And I think I'd encourage us to think of creative ways to get outreach done, whether it's, I was just speaking with the city of Madison, and they started doing, like, using AmeriCorps volunteers to do door-to-door kind of curbs about, like, some of the funding programs and things that they had for helping people reduce energy use or do recycling, and the ways that we can be doing that to get more participation in the programs that we have that really make people save money, but also just make it easier for them to know what we have, and also just good outreach.
Yep.
It gives you an opportunity to talk with, and they might then have something else that they want to share that is useful for us. So I want to explore us looking into more of those. Do you have more questions on this one? Okay. And so this one's kind of like the environmental center might come part of the conversation as we're talking about the MRF expansion, might be part of that RFP, I'm assuming.
Yes.
They might have an option.
Yes. That would be part of the RFP that we would propose. And then, we'll try to find financial incentives to increase commercial recycling. That's the end of that piece. The next piece is that, I don't remember exactly when, that we were directed at the end of a council meeting to come back with an ordinance to address the storage of roll carts when they're not at the curb for collection. And before we put this on the forward for council consideration, I think we were asked to do a public input meeting and put it out on our Be Heard site, so we have done both of those things. Here's a summary of what we got back from the IP meeting and from comments on the Be Heard site. It really wasn't any big citizen, really leaning that we don't have an ordinance that has more restrictions than what our current ordinance is, and there's not a big group that says don't make something that's more restrictive, so it's kind of up in the air. The city councilor has provided two draft ordinance options for us if we want to consider it. They're listed here. One is, says basically it's unlawful to place or store your refuse cart at any location on the premises which is not immediately adjacent to the structure. So I take that to mean it's got to be up against the side of the house, the back of the house, or the front of the house. And then the second option was unlawful to store or place it at any location on the premises which is not behind the building line of the side of the structure facing the principal street. And if it's stored in front of the building line of the structure, it must be stored in an enclosed structure so that it cannot be seen from the street. To me, that's on the side of the house, or it's got to be screened. So if council still thinks we need to have more restrictions than what's in our current code, which just says store on private property.
I was going to say, please clarify for us right now, what does it say?
What, right now it says they must be stored on private property, which means that you could go out, pull it a foot off the sidewalk and leave it in your front yard.
But the implication is just to make it, the ordinance is written more for like, put it out on the street for them to collect it and then bring it back once it's been collected.
Yes.
Okay.
And so we'd be happy to bring back either one of these if.
Betsy, you brought this up.
I did bring this up because the way it's currently written, you can have it a foot on your property, which is still seen from the street when you're driving down the street. It can be knocked into the sidewalk and can be knocked over, whatever. It's not up near the house. And at least in my neighborhood, that'll be a problem. I would go for the one that's the top one that says it just needs to be adjacent to a residential structure. I don't really want to get into where it has to be a fence and how big a fence does it have to be if it's in the front yard or it has to be on the side of the house and somebody's got shrubbery on the side of the house or the front of the house, whatever. I just would, you know, the complaints I would hear in this long ongoing saga of roll carts is that people did not want to see them like they are in Ashland and in Jeff City where they're on the street or they're rolling down the street or they're knocked over in the street. And I think this would prevent that from happening and it would be some clarification. And if someone says they don't like a roll cart up near the front, in front of the house, then my feeling is don't look at the house. I mean, you're driving down the street for Pete's sakes. The idea is not to have it in the street. So that's what I would go for. And that's why.
Don, you had your hand up.
I was just going to, given our previous conversation about recycling and going to automated recycling, just simply amend this. It says refuse. In the briefing, we differentiated between refuse and recycling cart. Include recycling carts in this now so we don't have to revisit it later. And I agree with Betsy. Item, I would recommend going with the first one, the shorter one, just get it off the street next to the house. Where you put it in relation to your house is up to you.
Nick Knoth.
Sorry, that was loud right in the mic. I'm happy. I shouldn't say happy, but I'm willing to support an ordinance. I don't think one's necessary. I'm open to amending our current rules. One thought I had was, you know, making it to where's we put an actual number into it, like matching the setback of your property or something of that nature to keep it further from the curb and whatnot.
You're implying that somebody knows the setback on their property.
Well, I mean, the layman's version of that would be like, you know, it can't be, you know, past your house, right? Between the house and the curb. You know, if there's a strong desire to do this, I won't oppose it either. I just don't know that it's necessary.
Any other thoughts or feedback on this one? For mine, I was kind of in the same. I think for me, it's that I worry about us becoming too burdensome with the rules of where to put these, right? And there might be someone's flexibility, and then they have a neighbor that does not like them. You know, and like just the calls we're going to, these pieces. So for me, I mean, if it's, I don't know. I don't necessarily like to police my neighbors. That's why I don't live in an HOA.
Yeah, but I think that this, I don't think this is overly burdensome. I think it does give people some clarity as to where they can keep their roll carts. And I'll just tell you, having driven by roll carts all week that are blocking the street, are blocking the sidewalk, that, I mean, these students might be able to get them on the other side of the sidewalk, but they're going to knock them over and they're going to be in the street, or they're going to be blocking the sidewalk. So I just think before we start this, it would be easier to have some clarification as to where this goes. And I know there's some issues about homeowners associations and where you can put them in. I don't want to get into that, but, you know, I do have people that have said, you know, we can't get our roll carts out from the back of the house. We can't, you know, can we leave them on the curb? It just, I think it would be clarifying for those who live in some of the older neighborhoods.
And so tonight the conversation is whether or not to come back to us. This is not us voting on anything. It would come back to us anyway. And then we would have more of the conversation and public comment and then and vote on an ordinance if we were doing a change.
That is correct.
Yeah. And hopefully we could make a decision before March 4th when I believe we're starting our parts.
Right. So ideally, if
we would give guidance, come back to us on the February 5th meeting. Yes. I guess it'd be a first read.
Be a first read on February 5th and then approval. It's a second meeting, the February 19th meeting.
Nick.
Just one technical question. Does a detached garage count as a residential structure in that first? Because a lot of homes in the central neighborhoods have detached garages, which I imagine is where some people are going to store them.
I would think so. The detached garages, I've not seen any in front of the house. I'm not sure there wouldn't be one in front of the house, but and in my neighborhood, the detached garages are behind the house. So either one, but
there's
could be
in front,
at the house. Do you have a problem with the fourth ward?
I was saying there is a we're just commenting of a detached. We're getting in the weeds. It's fine.
Okay. Well, get out of the weeds.
Okay. Well, this is literally. No, I'm just. Okay. So I think just to move it along, to have this come back to us for additional conversation. And it sounds like having the first one come back as far as what we see coming back to us.
That's all we had.
Are we running out of slides?
We're out of slides.
So we have one other item on our agenda. I think we're done with the rural CARC solid waste recycling conversation for the moment.
We are.
We have one other item on our agenda, and that is the conversation of a discussion around boards and commissions, which I think this is kind of the first one of multiple. Before I kick it over to Nick Knoth, who had kind of requested part of this, one of the things that I'm going to send over with council, and I've talked about this before, is, you know, we have over 50 boards and commissions that advise us, and we don't often hear from them unless, you know, it's time for appointments. We have multiple boards and commissions where we're constantly re-advertising vacancies on them, which can lead me to believe that maybe people who have served have left because what they didn't feel their time was useful, or the ask is too great. And so it's kind of like, I think we need to do more of a comprehensive check-in with our boards and commissions. In years past, we would send out kind of a questionnaire for like, what are you currently working on? What are your highlights? But also meeting with them. And so meeting with the chair and vice chair kind of like once a year or so, just trying to get, and it used to be like a Saturday, a few Saturday, you know what I mean, where you try to meet with a few or a different day, but trying to meet with them to kind of do a check-in and see what's happening. The thing that this does is that it does give us the opportunity for, if we have a board or commission that maybe it's not being utilized, these community volunteers, their time is not being utilized in the way that they wanted to donate it, that we could, maybe that board and commission doesn't serve its purpose anymore. And we can, just like we did with the Vision Commission, those are great volunteers who are now looking at other boards and commissions to serve on because that purpose was not set. So it allows us that opportunity. And so I'll send out some in past questionnaires that had gone out that can kind of start this discussion. But Nick, you had some specific ones that you were having questions on at a December meeting.
Yeah, and I second everything Barbara just said. You know, I think the issue of boards and commissions is something that has plagued every council and city manager in the last 20 years, and that, you know, every council creates new ones, but we never really get rid of any. Although the Vision Commission was example of, as you said, getting rid of one. And it goes to your point of, you know, managing our resources, both in terms of, you know, every one of these has, to my knowledge, has staff liaisons who have to spend time supporting them, ensuring they operate, they meet, reporting minutes, all those things. And to your point again, the time of our volunteers who we rely on, and condensing the number of boards and commissions would help both those cases. You know, what triggered this, my request on this one was the request from the Downtown Leadership Council to, somewhat forgetting what their request was, to kind of change their mission or prerogative.
And their geography boundaries.
And their geography, that was a big aspect of it. And I think that is representative in that case of they're searching for a reason to exist, and justifiably in their case. And I think that's a serious, while not the most important conversation for council to have, considering all the things that are always going on, an important one because they report to us, or supposed to, you know, in terms of options. One thing I thought of was, you know, as Barbara kind of suggesting that every annually a report from all of our boards and commissions individually, which some of them, a number of them do already because they're mandated to by the ordinance that established them. And I know in a few conversations I've had with some folks on boards and commissions is when they say, well, report on what? And I'm like, well, there's a different answer right there, isn't there? Like, you have nothing to report on. So my whole thing here is condensing and saving resources, both in staffing and volunteers, and focusing our efforts across the board.
Rachel?
I mean, I'll also add to, you know, thinking about the mission and the vision of each, you know, board or commission, is that also in line with our strategic plan and where everything is going? You know, we're going to have that retreat coming up, so... You know, how do all of these all fit together, and are there overlaps, or, you know, things that either we have achieved something, or, you know, like the vision one. So, yeah, I echo that.
Nick Foster.
Well, I was just looking to see. I think that each one of our boards and commissions has basically a mission statement, for want of a better term. And so I really would want to hear from each one of them about how they feel they're meeting that, whether or not that activity is true to what they're actually doing, and how they feel about how well they're meeting that. So reviewing their purpose, I think each one individually would be a good, maybe if not a good place to start, certainly something to be included in the process of review. Comparing some of them, we might find that there is definitely some overlap among those. So I really would want to do something where we hear back from each one of them.
Yeah.
And I just want to add real quick on that comment there. I think it's important we hear back, not only from the commissioners and members of the boards, but from the staff who work with those entities as well, because just like those boards and commissions are supposed to be a source of information and resources for us, they're also serving that purpose, or supposed to be, for staff as well.
Yeah. And obviously the training that needs to go into both for staff and for members of boards and commissions, besides just sunshine requirements, but also like meeting requirements. Yeah. Yeah. So besides sending along and kind of setting a schedule for, as far as like hearing back from boards and commissions and maybe having a future kind of work session conversation, what other, is there any sort of direction that you want to ask?
You know, I think that's a good first step. A good place for us to start is seeking feedback from both those serving and the staff who are liaisoned to those entities. And I'm open to feedback, especially on what DeCarlin thinks on this, if he's got thoughts.
No, just questions. And so when you ask for feedback, is that a survey? Because I think that we've done it in the past. We did a survey that went out to boards and commissions. I want to say that was back in 2011, or it was a while ago. And so is that the type of feedback you're looking for? First, let's do a survey to go out to the boards and commissions to kind of do a check-in.
Yeah, and I've got the form that was done in the past, which was kind of review, and I'll send that out to be a starting place. It was used, this was when I was on a commission, so for a few years, and I'm not sure how consistently it was, but that's at least a starting point.
Mm-hmm. See, I like the idea, though, of meeting with the chairman or the mm-hmm. vice chairman of the board or commission and asking them for their feedback, more specifically, a more active approach than the passive approach of just sending out a survey and hoping they return it.
Might be a good, you know, combination of both, right? Because I agree with you that the survey is not going to if one of the goals we have is to whittle down the number of boards and commissions, which I would say that should be a goal, then I don't know, no one's going to vote themselves out of a board or commission generally.
Well, I think it's a good question as to what is the goal. And, you know, I think there's a responsibility that we have about this as well. All these boards and commissions are not at our act, but previous councils, they come about because of the action of councils who have put them into place. And the reason that they've been put into place generally is so that council gets the benefit of all these citizens groups working really on our behalf and doing a lot of the legwork to help us in making in our decision making. So to me, that's the end of this. My guess is that if we were to go through and give a score as to how impactful these boards and commissions are to us individually, we might see them ranked somewhat in terms of their effectiveness and impact. That's not necessarily the fault or to the benefit of any individual board or commission, but just because of how they've been set up and what the current purpose is and how they're fulfilling that. So for me, the goal is what do we have in place in terms of boards and commissions that actually gets us to where we want to go with their work? And it's not so much about the numbers of them or which ones need to be combined or whatever. That certainly could be a part of what happens. But the goal is what do we do the most efficiently receive the kind of assistance and help, and we have the kind of citizen input into our decision making that we want to see.
Betsy.
I'll just also say, I know there was, I want to say it was the Building Codes Commission. I could be wrong, but I think it was that. When you get your rental inspections done, if the rental inspector says you need to make some change and you disagree, you can go to that committee and ask them for relief on that. Something that we don't really realize as part of the city council because it doesn't ever show up here, thankfully, but it does show up at that commission. So it would also be nice to get a better feel for what do these folks do to help the citizens.
Oh, well, and also, Nancy, I don't know what we call that, but those are those sort of, they're basically permissions that we have given to these appointees, right? Is that, because if it never comes to us.
Permission, I'm sorry.
I guess the question is more of like, what sort of additional powers are we giving to board, like which boards and commissions have some additional power that may be?
Right, okay, so there are a handful, those kind of come down to those boards and commissions that have the statutory authority, such as the Planning Commission, the Board of Adjustment. You've given specific powers to the Citizen Police Review Board. Those that are holding hearings and have that due process component to them.
So it's kind of asking that question as far as this questionnaire, just to ask. And that might be more for the staff liaison to answer city.
Human Rights Commission. I mean, yeah. We've identified most of those kind of throughout when we were talking about the virtual meetings, because those are the ones that have the due process components attached to them that they really need to provide substantive and procedural due process to folks with public hearings. So those can be identified, but generally boards and commissions don't get delegated independent spending authority with the exception of some very limited funds. So you've got your, I'll use cultural affairs, the Arts Commission. They have some spending authority that you grant them each year for grants. Normally those come back to you, but it's very specific.
Be a good idea though to look at all these committees and commissions, so I think it's a good idea to look.
It's a great idea to also have maybe fellow help with, because I don't know if we're going to ask for council to do this, but I think the end goal is really to make it more efficient use of staff time and our community members who are volunteering their time to advise us on these things. Yeah, Nick.
I just wanted to kind of follow up to Nick Foster's comments of and agree with everything that's been said, and that while I mentioned the numbers, it's really about effectiveness, right? The number is kind of irrelevant. It's more about, are they all being effective? Are they all serving a purpose?
And also while we're going through this, thinking about what you mentioned this as well, like, you know, there are some that have to provide an annual report, but not all do. Should there be a process in place so that this doesn't happen every however many years,
and I think it's the sort of thing too that we could be asking as far as it, we'll obviously ask vacancy? The questions like how often is there a spot vacant? Because for some of them, they might have more spots than they need, than we want. Some of those that we're constantly re-advertising. Others could be also attendance. Because obviously most of our boards and commissions have a requirement for showing up. But if they don't, or if people aren't showing up, we obviously want to have some sort of mechanism in place to ensure that people are respecting the, that otherwise open up a spot for somebody else to serve. Yeah. Anything else to this conversation? All right. Anything else for the good of the cause? Yes, Nick Foster.
Well, I just want to mention while we do have the sustainability folks in the room, I was very pleased to see that we were awarded the grant that's going to provide for the development of charging stations in our city. As a person who just recently purchased an EV and taken long trips in it and found some frustration in finding charging stations, I came back looking at what is true in Columbia specifically. And so very pleased to see that we'll see some advance in that upcoming. So good on you guys.
Anything else? Carly and Nancy, do you have anything? Christina, anything? No? All right. Well, go ahead and adjourn our work session at 7:06. Appreciate y'all. Thank